forward-moving. The Chinese foreign minister also provided a positive assessment of the relations. Wang described Iran as a key party to the Belt and Road Initiative, stressing the importance of its participation in an upcoming meeting. He additionally shared China's perspective on the forthcoming BRICS summit in South Africa. Iran is among several countries seeking BRICS membership. The Iraqi government has ordered the formation of a committee to follow up on the U.S. assassination of the top Iranian and Iraqi commanders back in January 2020. An Iraqi lawmaker says Prime Minister Mohammad Shia al-Sudani has called for a quadrilateral committee comprised of representatives from Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. Faleh al-Ghazali said the United States was the main protagonist behind the assassination of Iran's Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Deputy Commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes. The two anti-terror icons and some of their companions were killed in a U.S. drone strike outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-American President Donald Trump. Pakistani authorities have arrested two key opposition leaders in connection with an investigation into a diplomatic cipher. Detained former Premier Imran Khan claims it contained a threat from the United States to oust him from power. Our correspondent from Islamabad, Nasser Kazmi, has more in this report.
The vice chairman of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf Party, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, and party's former secretary general, Asad Umar, have been arrested by the authorities after being accused of misusing a secret official document. Under the country's Official Secrets Act, on disclosing the contents of a diplomatic cipher for political gains, the counter-terrorism wing of Pakistan's Federal Investigation Agency registered a case against the two former federal ministers, along with ex-premier Imran Khan. Khan was sacked from power in April 2022 after he lost a no-confidence vote in parliament. Since then, he has been accusing the United States of hatching a conspiracy with the help of his political opponents and the military to remove him from power through a diplomatic cipher. Khan is currently serving 3-year jail sentence after a court found him guilty in a corruption case earlier this month. He has also been barred from taking part in politics for 5 years. Just moments before his arrest late on Saturday, the former Pakistani foreign minister Qureshi condemned what he called a widening crackdown on his party by the interim government. He said that his party will knock on the door of the country's top court to ensure that the elections be held on time in a free and fair manner.
It was unfortunate that PTI leaders were being arrested and then released after an announcement that they want to part ways with PTI. The caretaker Prime Minister has said that he will ensure transparent elections. I would ask him how he will do so in such an environment. I would request the Chief Justice of Pakistan and the Election Commission to take notice and ensure a level playing field for PTI.
Political analysts believe that the upcoming polls would be considered as one of the most controversial elections in the history of the country in the absence of one of Pakistan's popular political parties, the PTI. In the light of the possibility that the general elections may be delayed due to Election Commission of Pakistan's decision to hold new delimitations, major political parties strongly condemned the ECP decision, warning that the unconstitutional postponement of elections could escalate into political instability and uncertainty.
According to the political commentators, if the current caretaker setup stretches beyond its constitutional tenure, a lingering period without an elected government could lead to military intervention in the cash-strapped country. Nasser Kazmi in Islamabad.
Hundreds of Palestinians are languishing in Israeli jails under the regime's so-called administrative detention policy. For many, hunger strike is the only option to make their voices heard. 9 Palestinian inmates are now on an indefinite hunger strike in protest at their detention. 2 of the detainees have been refusing food for 18 days. A third inmate began the strike 2 weeks ago. The 6 other inmates continue their food refusal for the 11th day in a row. According to the Palestinian Prisoner Society, Israeli prison service forces have stepped up their crackdown against the hunger-striking inmates. Israel keeps holding Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial. The so-called administrative detention is being enforced in defiance of international law. Wildfires are wreaking havoc in Canada's British Columbia. The devastation has forced the country to deploy its armed forces to the western province to help contain the blazes. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says the federal government has agreed to a request for assistance. The armed forces will be sent as the province has ordered over 35,000 people to leave the affected areas. Thousands more are also under evacuation alert. Authorities in British Columbia have imposed the travel restrictions to speed up the evacuation process as well as the operations to extinguish a fire. Canada is witnessing its worst wildfire season on record, with at least 1,000 active fires burning across the country. Several thousand people have rallied in the capital of Niger in support of last month's military coup. The demonstrators chanted slogans against former colonial power France and the West African regional bloc ECOWAS. They waved placards saying stop the military intervention and no to sanctions. Niger's military leaders say France is behind the anti-coup stance taken by ECOWAS. The bloc is considering a potential military operation to reinstate pro-Western President Mohamed Bazoum if ongoing negotiations with the coup leaders fail. ECOWAS has also imposed financial and trade restrictions on the country. The junta in Niamey has warned that an attack on Niger would not be a walk in the park. It says a transition of power back to civilian rule would not go beyond 3 years. Social justice activist Yahni Ndogo earlier joined us with her take on last month's coup in Niger.
The people in Niger have been speaking, and their voice is saying that they appreciate the coup. From the conversations that I've had with people in the region, there was actually a call amongst many in the community to actually have a coup, to remove the presidency, especially after what happened in the other countries in the region with Burkina Faso, Mali, Guinea, all overthrowing the colonial forces, that the people of Niger wanted the same thing. And so the people of Niger have the right to decide what happens in their own country. And so any outsiders, including ECOWAS, a neighboring country, or any of the members of that bloc interfering would actually be undermining the right to self-determination and the human rights of the people of Niger.
Now, China has carried out military drills around Taiwan in a stern warning to Washington following a visit by Taiwanese Vice President William Lai to the U.S. Chinese military officials said they deployed frigates, fast attack missiles, boats, fighter jets, and a number of other sophisticated weaponry as part of the drill.
The situation remains volatile around Taiwan as Chinese military has carried out joint exercises there. In a statement, the Chinese Defense Ministry said it carried out joint naval and air combat readiness patrols around the island. It said it was holding the exercises and training of naval and air forces, focusing on ship-aircraft coordination and seizing control to test the forces' actual combat capabilities. The Chinese military said the equipment deployed included destroyers, frigates, and missile boats, as well as fighters, early warning, and jamming aircraft that assembled in a predetermined area. Taiwan's defense ministry said it detected 42 Chinese aircraft and 8 ships involved in the drills around the island as of Saturday morning, and it had deployed ships and aircraft in response. The Chinese military said the maneuvers were a serious warning against Taiwan independent separatist forces colluding with external forces to provoke. Taiwan's government strongly condemned the drills. The Taiwanese Defense Ministry said it had the ability, determination, and confidence to ensure national security of Taiwan. The government's Mainland Affairs Council, which makes Taiwan's China policy, urged Beijing to stop what it called the intimidation and start talks, saying Taiwan's people were determined to defend themselves and would never succumb to threats of force. The council added Taiwan is a sovereign country and has a legitimate and legal right to conduct normal diplomatic interactions with friendly countries. The drill comes against the backdrop of a visit by Taiwan's Vice President William Lai to the United States. Lai, who was a frontrunner to become Taiwan's president in elections in January, made a number of stopovers and gave speeches while on the visit.
Now, the military drills by China come as Washington has maintained its provocative approach toward Beijing in recent years. Some of those measures include the U.S. trade deal with Taiwan, American officials' diplomatic visits to the self-ruled island, and the passage of U.S. warships through the Taiwan Strait. It's believed that Washington is supporting separatist calls in Taiwan to secure its own presence there and ultimately contain Beijing.
This stopover of Taiwan's vice president to the U.S. comes as previous instances of such diplomatic visits have been the source of tensions between Beijing and Taipei, and subsequently China and the United States. That includes a visit by former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi. Beijing launched joint military exercises around the island and suspended or canceled aid official military dialogues and cooperation channels with the United States. In April this year, Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen met House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on a stopover in California. Beijing authorities blasted off some angry statements, imposed sanctions against a handful of individuals or entities involved in Tsai's trip, and sent warships and planes past Taiwan. Not to mention that several U.S. delegations, comprising of American lawmakers, have traveled to the self-ruled island and met with Taiwanese officials, drawing angry reactions from Beijing. China argues that any official exchanges with Taiwan will boost calls for independence in the self-ruled island. But apart from those diplomatic exchanges, tensions over Taiwan have been escalating ever since the United States enhanced its military buildup in the South China Sea in an effort to contain Beijing. After all, China has territorial claims over the self-ruled island and has warned against any move that jeopardizes its sovereignty and territorial integrity. But regardless of those warnings, Washington has continued with its collision course with Beijing over the issue of Taiwan. The sailing of U.S. vessels through the Taiwan Strait is just to name one. That raises the question that how would the United States react if Chinese destroyers sail through areas close to U.S. borders in the North Atlantic or the North Pacific Oceans, or anywhere near the Gulf of Mexico for that matter. Given all the tensions between Washington and Beijing, what seems to be further complicating the situation is numerous provocations on the part of the United States against China. From those diplomatic visits to sailing of warships to areas close to Taiwan, all seems to be preparing the ground for full-scale confrontation between the two countries.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The brutal killing of Arab and black youths by French police will continue until the Republic's deep-seated structural racism is tackled. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, for clinical or cynical reasons worth investigating, French political elites have been reenacting a disturbing narrative which frames their relationship with the people they are supposed to lead for over two centuries. In this nightmare vision, a horde of angry people raid the mansions and ministries of the Republic, or the King, or the Emperor, claiming the heads of their leaders and parading them on sticks. And the only hope they can rely on, the only force they can count on to save them, is the police. The forces of order, as they are referred to in France, strive to protect their order as a power structure of domination operating in two dimensions. The first dimension is social and economic, maintaining privileges where they belong. For the benefit of the nobles and bourgeois yesterday and today, at the service of major corporate and capitalistic interest. The second is racial and political, building on the legacy of stereotypes and structural discrimination inherited from the French colonial empire. In both dimensions, the police are there to implement the government's political vision. They curb the demonstrations, guard the banks, criminalize political opponents, harass Arab and black kids at a disproportional rate, and on occasion kill them. This is why, on the night of October 17, 1961, the French police killed hundreds of Algerian demonstrators by throwing them into the Seine. This is why, on November 29, 1972, the French police shot Mohamed Diab in the chest and back after beating him, while his mother and his sister watched the whole scene from the window. This is why, on October 16, 1984, the French police shot Salim Bouzari in his car after he went through a red light. This is why, on December 6, 1986, the French police beat Malik Asakin to death when he was just walking in Paris after a concert. This is why, on April 6, 1993, the French police killed 17-year-old Makome Meboli at a Paris police station by shooting him at point-blank range. This is why, on October 27, 2005, Zaid Bena, 17, and Buna Traore, 15, were running for their lives in a Paris suburb, terrified of the police, eventually killed by being electrocuted in a power substation, although they had done nothing wrong. This is why Adama Traore died in police custody in July 2016 before his siblings were almost systematically criminalized, harassed, and ostracized for calling for the truth about Traore's death. And this is why, on June 27, 2023, in Nanterre, a Paris suburb, 17-year-old Noël Merzour was shot and killed at point-blank range like hundreds of other young men before him. Many of these deaths reveal a racial bias in the way young black and Arab men are constructed as a security threat to France. But it is important to point out that they are not the only targets of police violence. Cedric Chauviat, for instance, a 42-year-old delivery man, died of asphyxia and a broken larynx at the hands of the French police after using his cell phone on his scooter in January 2020. In October 2014, Remy Fraisse, a 21-year-old botanist, was killed by a grenade fired by the French police. And in June 2019, Steve Maya Kaniko was found dead in the River Loire after police had raided the concert in Nantes he was attending. The dynamics vary, but some structural factors remain at play. Firstly, black and Arab kids are constructed as a threat, inherited from post-colonial racist tropes, and disproportionately targeted by the French police. A study has shown that black male youths have a 6 times greater chance of being stopped by the police than white males, and Arab youths an 8 times greater chance. Secondly, the security approach implemented by the French police towards black and Arab young men is deeply rooted in the political structures of the country and warrants unsolicited and unjustifiable violence, leading on hundreds of occasions to death. Third, this racially biased approach focused on black, Arab, Muslim, and migrant communities acts as a lab, which in turn informs and influences the way security is implemented at a much wider level, affecting the fundamental freedoms and safety of all citizens. Fourthly, more than half of the police force votes for the far right, and now, through their unions and representatives, uses lobbying techniques and threats to advance their political agenda, furthering even more the divide between the general population and the very institution whose mission is to protect them. And lastly, the office in charge of investigating police violence and abuses is made up of police officers, resulting in a dismal number of cases actually looked at, with almost no sanctions, resulting in a total absence of trust in the institution and its accountability. As long as the French government does not hold the police accountable when they break the laws they are supposed to enforce and the values they are supposed to uphold, no charge can be expected in the foreseeable future. Political elites in France will continue to maintain this toxic relationship with the police. Thereby, they protect each other while endangering the security of all. According to Press TV, the United Nations Human Rights Office said, "The unrest in France showed that it was time for this country to reckon with its history of racism in policing rather than just lash out in punishment." Press TV noted that the Human Rights Office said the French government needed to ensure that the use of force always respects the principles of legality, necessity, proportionality, non-discrimination, precaution, and accountability.
Food for thought.
Salam, listeners. Let us listen to a short and sweet aphorism from Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, the 15th infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, who, according to a narration, was born this day on the 3rd of Safar. Laziness harms both the worldly and the religious affairs.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, not passing judgment before we listen to both sides. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear friends, it's an honor to be here at your service. We are talking about how we must not pass judgment before listening to both sides. Before we talk about this concept here, it is really so beautiful and refreshing to realize and know that Islam and the Holy Quran and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, they have such beautiful statements regarding judging. You know, we live in a world where there's courts and all of these governments, there are judges, there are lawyers, there are plaintiffs, you know, and the modern era in the present day. But it is so refreshing and it's really a miracle and it shows you this beautiful light and guidance and this divine source of Islam, where you find so many intricate things about judgment, about court of law, that were spoken about well over 1,000 years ago, well before this modern age of modernism and technological and scientific advancement. At times it seems like we live in a modern age of ignorance rather than a modern age of modernity. But talking about this idea that we should really listen to both sides before we pass judgment, this is a issue that was not only an issue at that time over 1,000 years ago, and even before that 1,000 years ago it was an issue, but if we come to the present day, this is also an issue. Of course, at the present time, we're talking about the judgments and the position of judgment that we have amongst our society as an individual, where we have to judge, we have to listen to both sides. And now we continue and inshallah conclude the discussion after the break. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about this idea that we must listen to both sides before we make a judgment. This is really part and parcel of our Islamic lifestyle, of course, because as we have said in some of our programs, we are one day or the other, at one point or the other, we are faced with having to make a judgment between two individuals or more. Now, sometimes, unfortunately, well, before we listen to the other side, we kind of listen to one side and we just, you know, believe that one side without listening to the other side. And a lot of times this happens with children. You know, you have two or more children, you listen to one child and they say one aspect of the story. And then before you listen to the second child, you know, you end up passing judgment and you know, you realize that maybe the second child was right. And it's just like this chaos that's happening. What do you do to prevent this, whether it's on the level of a family or a community or a society, is to listen to both sides, to listen intently, and just before we end the program, to the both sides, please make sure that you are honest in your statements, be truthful, tell the truth, so that the judge can make a good judgment call, whether it is in a situation with our friends or our family or our co-workers. Of course, listen to both sides before making a judgment, inshallah, in our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The Prime Minister. Part 2.
In the mid-20th century, British and American diplomats traveling to Iran to negotiate oil deals were advised to view Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. Viewing Alice's Adventures in Wonderland was regarded as the best way for the foreigners to gain insight on Iran and its politicians. But for the Westerners, this man remained to be the most enigmatic politician of his era. What made Mohammad Mossadegh the greatest politician of his time? What decisions did he make? and what became of him at the end. The bloodiest war in human history has ended. The Second World War's uninvited guests should be leaving the country. However, before they leave Iran, they want to make sure the great treasures beneath the land would be safely taken care of by their elements. The rights to discover, excavate, refine, and export oil belongs exclusively to Britain. They were plundering Iran's vast oil reserves. The Shah of Iran, who refrained from confrontation with Britain, ordered the court minister, Abdul Hossein Hajir, to interfere in the elections of the 16th Majlis. The Shah's indirect interference in the general elections was met with strong protests led by Mossadegh. Mohammad Mehdi Abdkhodai, who was a young teacher and a street vendor, as well as a Fadaiyan Islam member at the time, gives us the details of the protests. Mohammad Mossadegh, titled Mossadegh al-Saltaneh, was a descendant of the Qajar dynasty. He was a wealthy landowner who had studied in Switzerland and supported the Iranian constitutional revolution. He had been a foreign minister in the past and was currently the leader of the National Front. The 70-year-old politician from Ahmadabad set forth his plan. He declared his readiness to accept the premiership if his conditions were met. In a symbolic gesture conveying the message of a nation's newly gained independence, the British flag is brought down and the Iranian flag raised in its place. The move can only have one clear message to the world. Iran has claimed control of its oil resources. The U.S. president responded to the Iranian prime minister's request for aid, promising to send his special representative to Iran. Dr. Mossadegh is happy with this response. Avril Harriman, the U.S. president's special representative, arrives in Tehran leading a team of negotiators.
Mr. Harriman, who was welcomed by the American ambassador, is used to these special missions, many of which he carried out for President Roosevelt.
Harriman's arrival coincides with the anniversary of the Two-Day Party's strike. The rallies turn violent after government agents intervene. 16 people are killed in the clashes. Mossadegh accuses Minister of Interior Affairs, Fazlullah Zahedi, of instigating the violence and dismisses him from his post. There is no connection between the violence and Harriman's visit. However, British and American news outlets claim the unrest was meant to make the negotiations fail. Harriman wanted to convince Mossadegh that the export of oil was not an easy task and required specialized knowledge. For this reason, Harriman advised Mossadegh not to insist on taking control of the country's oil industry. He said the right decision for Iran was to negotiate a deal with the British government. Mossadegh, who was lying on his metal bed, told Harriman with a laugh that the Americans were not aware of how annoying the British were. He said whatever the British touch gets contaminated and becomes unclean.
Mr. Harriman's visit, which aims to show Persia the dangers in the path she chose, seems to be bearing fruit.
Harriman is unsuccessful in convincing Mossadegh, so he turns to the Shah. The Shah tells Harriman that if he fails to strike a deal with Mossadegh, matters could get complicated. He says to the U.S. president that as long as Mossadegh remains to be a popular figure, matters needed to be resolved through him alone as the sole option. Harriman then tries to indirectly influence Mossadegh by seeking help from the prime minister's main religious supporter, Ayatollah Kashani. Ayatollah Kashani, who knows well why the Americans are playing the role of mediator, tells Harriman that the Iranian nation does not trust the Americans. He sees nationalizing oil as a religious duty, and he is strongly opposed to foreigners' control over the Muslim country. Harriman's mission in Iran lasted 40 days. After a lot of pushing and pulling, Mossadegh agrees to negotiate with the British side if they accept the nationalization of the Iranian oil industry. The British and Americans' hopes for striking an oil deal went up when Mossadegh agreed to hold fresh talks. Stokes arrived in Tehran with a secret package. He brings along an MI6 colonel faking as an interpreter. The MI6 agent's mission is disclosed in the first meeting with Mossadegh, and the negotiations break down. Apparently, the bottom line for the Americans and British is that the nationalization of Iran's oil industry should be factitious, so they remain in control of Iran's oil reserves.
Back to report the failure of his efforts to solve the oil crisis comes Mr. Richard Stokes. He offered Mossadegh the whole organization in Persia. The offer was refused because we insist on a British general manager, without whom the British staff would not work under Persian control.
Stokes' efforts, like the efforts of Harriman, came to an end without reaching any result. Stokes returns empty-handed to his country. After Stokes' offer got rejected, the negotiations broke up and Mossadegh ordered British oil technicians to leave Iran. In the week following Mossadegh's order, British technicians working for the Anglo-Iranian oil company left the country.
Now, you're just the man I want, because I'd like to know what you think about this evacuation, the sudden evacuation.
Well, I think it's rather a pity. One of the reasons is that Persians cannot run their refinery, all their oil distribution, without British technicians at all.
You're quite certain about that, are
you? Oh, I'm absolutely certain. On a 100% basis, it's just impossible.
Mm. Do you anticipate that we should be going back soon?
Well, I hope so.
Yes.
For the benefit of UK and the world in general.
As tensions rise, the British oil company's manager reports that as long as Mossadegh is in power, there will never be an oil deal between Britain and Iran. The U.S. ambassador to Tehran secretly visits the Shah and asks him to dismiss Mossadegh. The Shah agrees to remove Mossadegh from his post. However, due to the prime minister's high level of popularity at the time, the Shah is scared to take action. After oil negotiations officially fail, the British government lodges a complaint against Iran at the United Nations Security Council. Iran is accused by Britain of posing a threat to global security. Mossadegh's arrival in New York is met with a warm welcome by the residents. The U.S. Secretary of State, who attended Mossadegh's reception, said he saw a frail old man with a cane limping along the platform rush towards him ahead of the others to pay homage. At the UN headquarters, Mossadegh listed the crimes and cruelties committed by the British side against the Iranian nation, accusing London of causing problems and creating a crisis in the country by making military threats and slapping sanctions on the nation. Mossadegh also tells them that the UN Security Council and the Hague Court were not qualified to pass legal judgment on the Iranians' nationalization of the country's oil industry.
Met last week for what turned out to be one of its most historic meetings. Mr. Mossadegh, the Prime Minister of Persia, made his long-awaited appearance. And as he walked into the council chamber, leaning for support on the arm of Mr. Trigva Lee, his appearance caused such commotion among the crowd of press photographers that the proceedings were held up for several minutes. When calm had been restored, Mr. Mossadegh addressed the council in French.
Monsieur le Président,
Mr. Mossadegh challenged the council's competence to deal with the oil dispute. He accused Britain of having trespassed upon Persia's right to nationalize her resources, an accusation that brought this reply from Sir Gladwyn Jebb.
Mr. President, it won't have escaped your attention that many of the allegations and imputations of His Excellency are manifestly inaccurate, not to say willfully distorted.
After a few days of deliberations, the UN Security Council issues a statement which is considered a sort of victory for the Iranian nation. Mossadegh, who was wary of the plots by the British government, wraps up the business at UN headquarters in New York and heads to Washington, D.C. to hold talks with U.S. officials to gain their support. Mossadegh meets with U.S. President Harry S. Truman. He asks Truman to help the Iranian nation fight against the economic sanctions slapped on them by the British government. In the meantime, the United States and Britain have started a fresh round of secret negotiations, which Mossadegh is unaware of. Britain insists that no deal is better than a bad deal with Mossadegh. It proposes to wait until Mossadegh is gone and then strike a deal with his successor. The American representative assigned to tell Mossadegh that the negotiations were done wrote in his memoirs that when he entered the Iranian prime minister's quarters, he heard him ask in a very hopeless tone whether he had come to send him home. The prime minister, who is now in a worse situation than before, asks the U.S. to at least garner support by extending financial aid to his administration. As a farewell gift, President Truman promises a $23 million loan to Mossadegh's administration in accordance to the Point 4 program. The promise, however, is never made true, and Mossadegh's government never receives financial aid. In accordance to Truman's Point 4 program, a couple of cows and chickens were sent to Iran, and that was that.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The greatest Eurasia solar telescope construction has begun in Russia. The telescope will allow scientists to explore the thin structure of the photosphere, inaccessible to small diameter telescopes and orbital observatories. It also allows for spectral analysis and obtaining unique data on magnetic fields and the motion of matter to investigate the causes of solar flares, coronal ejections, and other phenomena in the sun. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, with the first stone laid in the foundation of the future telescope, experts anticipate this marvel of scientific engineering to be the most complex and expensive instrument within the National Heliogeophysical Complex. The project's cost is estimated to be around 36 billion rubles, and the telescope should be fully operational by 2030. In what is a groundbreaking development, construction has begun on the largest solar telescope in Eurasia, situated near the breakthrough Lake Baikal in the Republic of Buryatia, close to the border of Mongolia. The Institute of Solar Terrestrial Physics of the Siberian branch of the Russian Academy of Sciences is spearheading this ambitious project, which forms a crucial part of the National Heliogeophysical Complex in Russia. Sergei Olemskoy, the first deputy director of the ISTP, told Russian news agency, "The design of the telescope was completed last year. This year, we plan only to prepare the construction site. At the beginning of next year, subcontractor organizations will be engaged for certain types of work. The state-of-the-art telescope is designed to unlock the mysteries of the sun's magnetic fields and solar activity cycle. Researchers aim to study the sun's photosphere in unprecedented detail, enabling an in-depth analysis of solar flares, coronal mass ejections, and the other solar phenomena. This invaluable instrument is poised to address both fundamental and practical scientific questions." The telescope's optical scheme boasts 13 mirrors, with the primary mirror boasting a massive 3-meter diameter and constructed from a special glass ceramic material called astrosteel. This innovative design, comprising a tower, technological equipment building, lab, and administrative buildings, will reach a towering height of 42 meters and weigh a staggering 120 tons. Dmitry Kolobov, head of the Lab of Experimental Solar Physics and Astrophysical Instrumentation, expressed excitement about the selected location near Lake Baikal, citing the unique astroclimate created by the mountains and the lake. "This choice promises approximately 10% effective observing time per year, essential for studying the sun's corona." The significance of the Sun's study stems from its profound impact on spacecraft, near-Earth space, above-ground infrastructure, and human health. As communication and navigation satellites multiply with the country's development, predicting and understanding solar influences becomes imperative to ensure safety. Gennady Krasinkov, president of the Russian Academy of Science, said, "We have to forecast it, and not only to enrich knowledge around our luminary, but most importantly, to make our lives safe." With the construction of the solar telescope underway, scientists are excited to unveil the secrets of the sun, a venture that will deepen our understanding of the universe, while ensuring the safety and advancement of technology here on Earth. The National Heliogeophysical Complex is a mega science project with the goal to achieve groundbreaking scientific breakthroughs. It encompasses a range of facilities spread across the Arctic region and Boreatia. By 2030, the complex will comprise a multi-wavelength radio heliograph, a radar system, a mesostratospheric lidar, and a heating stand, all of which are essential for studying near space, the magnetosphere, ionosphere, and Earth's upper atmosphere. According to TASS news agency, the telescope will become the most complex and expensive instrument of the National Heliogeophysical Complex being created in Russia. The first stone in the foundation of the future telescope was laid on Saturday, August 13. Sergei Olemskoy, first deputy director of the ISSF, told TASS news agency, "The design of the telescope ended last year. We have received a positive conclusion of Glavosepsisia, a construction permit, and this year an order of the government of the Russian Federation was issued on the start of construction of a unique scientific instrument, a solar telescope," According to him, the telescope will be the largest in Eurasia. In 2023, the work will be limited to the preparation of the construction site and subcontractors, for certain types of work will be involved from the beginning of 2024. The object will appear on the territory of the Sion Solar Observatory of the ISSF near the village of Mundi. The cost of the instrument is approximately 36 billion rubles, and its commissioning is scheduled for 2030. TASS News Agency added the telescope will allow scientists to explore the thin structure of the photosphere, inaccessible to small diameter telescopes and orbital observatories. It also allows for spectral analysis and obtaining unique data on magnetic fields and the motion of matter to investigate the causes of solar flares, coronal ejections, and other phenomena in the sun.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's program, we'll be discussing the Iranian foreign minister's recent trip to Islamabad and how former Pakistani minister Imran Khan's dismissal from office happened under directions of the US. So stay tuned.
A special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Iranian minister's recent visit to Pakistan. And we shall also take a look at U.S. conspiracy behind Imran Khan's removal as Prime Minister.
In a recent diplomatic development, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, in response to an invitation from his Pakistani counterpart, Bilawal Bhutto Bardari, led a delegation to Islamabad. This marks the first bilateral visit of the head of Iran's diplomatic apparatus to Pakistan. Amir Abdollahian's mission is aimed at enhancing bilateral relations, activating economic trade collaborations, and fortifying security alliances. The visit was driven by Iran's neighbors' policy, which focuses to strengthen the bonds between the two Islamic countries, promoting regional stability.
Amidst a backdrop of regional dynamics and shared interests, Iranian Foreign Minister's trip to Pakistan culminated in a series of high-level meetings and substantial agreements. This high-profile visit was marked by comprehensive discussions and agreements spanning across economic, political, and security issues. Notably, a five-year commercial trade agreement for 2023 to 2028 was signed, targeting a substantial elevation of trade volume, $5 billion. Additionally, the document for the third session of Pakistan-Iran Joint Investment Committee and a protocol for economic and trade cooperation between the two countries were also a part of the bilateral agreements. The Pakistani foreign minister expressed his confidence, believing that the presence of relations between the two countries will lead to long-term double economic partnership. For strategic relations experts, agreements and understandings reached during the recent engagements have the potential to shape not only bilateral dynamics, but also influence the broader tapestry of regional stability and prosperity.
As we know, Iran and Pakistan have long-standing historical, cultural, and economic ties. The recent visit by Foreign Minister Abdollahian unveiled a similar regional cooperation extending beyond economic vistas, which, according to experts, have paved to strengthen the ties between